If you go outside, there is literally a house being destroyed before our very ears. Let's see. Percy Bysshe Shelley and his friends, Mary and Lord Byron, sometimes John Polidori, but we forget about him, even though he wrote a book about a vampire that caused an entire genre to be born.
We're not using that in the show.
The vampire genre. He called the book Vampire.
We watched the movie.
Which movie?
The Vampire.
There's no vampire movies. That one wasn't based on John Polidori, though.
Okay.
That was just... So John Polidori, only he and Mary Shelley's works from that night, the big night, went on to become famous. Not really famous, like, anymore. Like, his is just, like, only, like, people who are like, oh, I love vampires so much, there's nothing left to read. Only they're the ones who, like, read Polidori's book. Yeah, I think we're talking about a famous book and not a famous movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is it The Strain?
No.
Is it The Troll Hunter?
No.
Is it The Strain 2? More Strains?
God, no.
The Strain 3? Here comes...
It's Strain number 25.
Soul Strain? No, we are actually talking about...
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Frankenstuffer, the big one. This is the one that everyone's been waiting for.
Is it?
People are very excited about these episodes.
Why?
Because this is... Well, why are we even... Wait, first of all, I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
That's true.
Hey everyone, I'm Phil.
And I'm Molly.
And
it's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time. And yay. We are, hey,
woo,
woo,
hooray,
back in the saddle. So you may have heard, not you, but the listener at home, not you sitting across from me.
Yeah, I figured that
but the listener at home may have heard that we are not doing a movie this week.
Well, for the next 4 weeks.
For the next 4 weeks. Why not? What is going on? Did we stop watching movies?
Yes. We completely cut movies out of our life.
Yeah, it's no terrible. More,
no, it's Halloween season.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Oh, wait. Spooks and ghosts and ghosts and goblins, ghosts and goblins, Halloween. And what does that have to do with anything?
Well, it's the spooky season.
It is the spooky season, but we cover spooky movies.
Yeah, but this is the spooky season where we have to cover something especially spooky and well-known.
Well-known and spooky.
To remain on brand.
So since there are no well-known spooky movies in the world.
Well, we do movies all the time. It's time to do something special.
Something special. And this was your idea.
It was my idea.
And what was your big idea?
We should read Frankenstein and then do episodes talking about it.
Now admit it. It's a little self-serving.
It is.
Why?
Because I have to read this book in English and have conversations
about
it.
I was like, it was written in English. It's not very unusual. Most people read Frankenstein in the class,
yeah,
English.
In my AP Lit class.
Yes. And surprisingly enough, when I posted about us doing this, some friends of mine were like, oh man, that was like the best part of English was reading. And I was like, I didn't know people read Frankenstein in school. Like, I didn't know that was a thing, but I guess...
Shout out to Mr. Doty, who's going to be listening to these episodes.
Mr. Doty, woo! Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I didn't know. We've made it to the second tier.
One of my teachers is listening to our podcast.
That's pretty exciting. That is pretty exciting. The fascinating thing about this is, because I mean, I think it would seem that, like, just in the last, like, I'm going to date myself here, but in the last, like, 25 years, Frankenstein has been more and more accepted into the literary canon. Like, it's always been a classic, mm-hmm. but now it's being really just taught in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any idea, like, what you're going to focus on in class, or
I'm pretty sure we're focusing mostly on, like, elements of fiction,
mm-hmm.
and, like, literary analysis and stuff.
Okay, I mean, that makes sense
because that's what we're doing right now, but I don't really know what the future holds for Frankenstein.
What the future holds for Frankenstein? We don't know what the future holds for Frankenstein because we haven't gotten to that part yet. And the reason we haven't gotten to what happens to Frankenstein is because what are we talking about today?
We're talking about the first volume
of
Frankenstein
from
Mary Shelley.
year?
1818.
So this is, it's wacky. That's a stupid term.
It's wacky.
It's wacky. This is a wacky. It's any, so once upon a time, if you went to go buy Frankenstein in the store, you got a copy of the 1831. The 1831 edition.
I don't know why I said 35.
I mean, they were printing it then. You got the, so, but what happened is, so she published this book in 1818, and then 20 some odd years later went back and rewrote it.
Well, the ambiance of the chainsaw is really adding to the podcast.
Hopefully the chainsaws and the motor machines are not being picked up on the microphones. I think we're in the clear. I have the gain turned way down. But there are a lot of machines going on outside, tearing down a house, literally tearing a house down.
Well, they were just furnishing it and stuff.
They're like gutting it. There's like windows on the lawn. Not in like a spooky haunted house for Halloween.
Spooky.
And so she wrote this book, and then 20 some odd years later, she went back and she rewrote it. A lot had happened in her life. Remember, she was how old when she first started writing this?
19?
Like 19, 18, 19 years old. And
by the time she rewrote it, a bunch of her children had died.
She had had dead children. She had a dead husband.
Well, technically, she'd had a dead child before she finished the book.
Right. So that's another fascinating thing is it took her like a year and a half to write this. Mm-hmm. Like, and while she was writing the original draft, a lot of stuff went down in her life.
Like her son dying.
Yeah. And like having to move and writing it. She wrote another book about her like travels with her husband. Like, she was a busy young person.
You know what's really cool about my edition of this book?
What?
It has a bunch of like author's notes in it.
Yeah.
Which like says oh, this is where Percy started writing this paragraph. Mm-hmm. And like, oh, this is in reference to her dead son.
So I have a copy of it as well that actually has, they went, so Percy Shelley, who at the time, well, when she started writing it, they weren't married. And while she was writing it, they got married because his wife hadn't died yet. You'll hear a little bit more about this in our Bride of Frankenstein episode. But she wrote the first draft, and then they kind of collaborated on it. Mm-hmm. It's still her book, but he added.
Can really tell when he starts writing because he uses the word like whilst and stuff. She doesn't really do that. He's more like poetry,
right?
But she's very like science and straightforward.
So we don't have her original drafts, but we have the copy that he made his initial notes on. And I have a book that actually took all of his editions out, and so you can just read it as she wrote it, which is cool. It's obvious she wasn't a novelist at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very clunky, and you can see where they collaborate. I wouldn't say that he was a better novelist than she was, but you can see where it helped to have an editor, like someone who went through and was like, you should clean this up. This would sound better. There's a few things he threw in, a few flourishes he threw in that I was like, he threw in whole paragraphs though at times, like of description, and a few of his like personal politics make it in.
And like, there's a lot of like stuff in reference to both of their childhoods.
Yeah.
Like books, titles, and just like general stuff.
And, but it really was a collaboration as far as the editing went, but it's still her book. Like,
yeah.
This is, make no bones about it. You can actually see whose handwriting was whose on the original like work print. So she went back in the 20s, in the 1820s, and rewrote parts of it for a two-volume version that kind of gets lost. It's kind of lost to history. It's out there, but she wrote some new stuff. She changed some stuff. And then she went back for the big revision in 1831. Which,
in 1931, about 1931. More than 100 years later.
She, her life had changed, and she changed some substantial descriptions in the book. She made the main character, she made Victor Frankenstein, the way it's usually described is less a victim of his choices and more a victim of fate. There's a lot, she added a lot of stuff about how like he couldn't have stopped this even if he'd wanted to. He was caught up, from the moment he was born, he was a victim of fate. And
I don't know how, if I like the fact that like he realized the like what he did, and he's like, this is what I did, and I have to do something about it because no one else can.
So for a long time, people accepted the 1831 version as the ultimate version, like the good version, like, because obviously she went back and she wrote what she always wanted to, kind of like but it was kind of like the George Lucas thing with Star Wars, where she went back and changed it to fit her at that point current attitudes, but that. In recent-ish years, literary critics have gone back and said, like, wait a minute, the 1818 version, while not perfect, is really readable, and that kind of has, like, the themes that she was thinking about when she was that age.
Like, and, like, the characters are amazing.
Yeah. There's a couple of major changes between the two that we'll touch on. But so that's why this is all a roundabout way of explaining why we chose the 1818 version.
Well, that, and there was no 1831 version when we looked to get it for me.
Well, I thought this would be a nice one because it's divided into three books with clear divisions. Mm-hmm. So that'll give us three episodes to cover the plot and then
an episode to tie it all together.
Yeah, episode to just say, like, so let's talk about everything.
Let's talk about the meaning of life.
Yeah, so if you're reading along at home, we're just covering the first book today, which is a chunk of story.
It really is.
It is
only 69 pages long, though.
Depending on your edition.
Yeah.
I read it with very large type on my tablet, my phone, and it's about a billion pages. So
I read it like an old person.
I've read the published version, I read the annotated version, and then I read her initial draft that's available. So just to get an idea of, like, I love, how did it work? How did it happen? Like, how did it, like, you can just dig through their notes exist. So you can just sort of like see how the mind works. Just love that. Like, this isn't a mystery to us. We know what she wrote. Like, mm-hmm. So I guess let's just talk about this book. What is this? Like, we know the movies, mm-hmm. but for those listening at home, what's this book about?
Well, we're just talking about section one, so.
Yeah. It doesn't even start off
with Frankenstein or Victor.
Yeah.
It starts off with some guy.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name?
His name is Robert Walton.
It starts off with Robert Walton,
mm-hmm.
and he is going to the Arctic to explore the ice.
And it's not just a book, it's letters.
It's letters to his sister.
Mm-hmm. Who, so this is our first, like, big, like, hint that Mary Shelley had something going on in her mind, is that the sister's initials are MWS, which are the same initials as Mary Wollstonecraft,
mm-hmm.
Shelley.
Yeah.
So she's drawing parallels between characters right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is this guy Robert Walton like? Is he some hardened sea dog?
No. I mean, kind of, because he's, like, done all of this. Like, he's spent years, like, working with sea sailors.
Mm, but he wanted to be a
explorer.
He wanted to be a poet.
A poet,
for
right.
A while.
But he was like, that didn't work. Yeah. I suck at writing poetry.
He really did. I love that whole part. He's like, you know what that year was like. It didn't come to anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's writing to his sister because he's heading off on an Arctic adventure.
Yeah.
And what is his hope for the Arctic?
To find new things.
To find, like, the Northern Passage.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the concept of the Northern Passage?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's for the listeners who don't. We were convinced that we were going to find a way to, like, jump over the top of the earth by, like, cutting through the Arctic. There had to be a way through all this ice that would...
There had to be a ramp that we can drive our boats onto, and it would just go
just phew. Pick up speed and just fly over those big icebergs. They didn't know that if they simply waited a couple hundred years, all that ice would be gone.
It's true.
But
that's too real.
But it was a pretty dangerous thing to try to do because the ice would close in on your boats and crush you and kill you. Like, that's just, it happened. What I like about Robert Walton is he's just sort of this
guy,
affable guy.
He's nice. I like him.
Yeah, he loves his sister. He wanted to be a explorer, but his dad said no. And then his dad died and left him a bunch of money.
And he was like, ha, screw you. I'm going to go explore.
Yeah, I couldn't be a poet. That didn't work out. But he's not like some fancy rich boy. Like you said, he puts in the work.
Yeah, like he trained. He worked for people. Like, he's not just like, oh, you all have to do all of this for me. Like, no, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he's pretty up on things. He puts himself there with the rest of the
And he also accepts
sailors.
Criticism.
Mm-hmm. he's kind of your just nice dude. Guy, yeah. But also self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this already, this theme of young people who teach themselves through books things that maybe their station in life wouldn't have normally prepared them for. And that's kind of a thing that runs through this. All the characters are kind of these young, intellectual, book learning geniuses. Mm-hmm. And I think that may have a little something to do with Mary Shelley's
upbringing.
And
well, considering the only like friend she had when she was younger was books, that's not surprising. Yeah.
These characters are all of a type, and yeah. And you learn a lot about their childhoods. So why are we spending all this time with Robert Walton, though? Like, why are we going?
That's like half the first book.
Why are we going to the Arctic in the first place? Like,
because there's a spooky boy in the Arctic.
What happens in the Arctic?
Well, they get walled in by ice, and then they see this sled in the Arctic, and they're like, "The heck?
Yeah,
the hecking heck?
Yeah,
what is hecking happening?
Because there's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and they're like, "Okay, that was weird.
But who's on this sled?
It's the monster.
It's really far away. Like you can't. You don't know what it is though at this point.
Yeah.
They just know it's a
really tall, monstrous looking man.
Yeah, like he's far off in the distance. So they're like, that guy's really big. And then he just sort of like sleds out of sight. I assume like there's enough. The ice is close and like it's it's contiguous enough that he can safely sled across this ice.
And they're like, well, okay.
I guess that's done.
And then they like stay there for a couple of days while the ice like departs. And then who shows up? Mr. Victor himself.
Some guy.
Strange man.
Because if there's one thing we don't know about this guy yet, it's that his name is Victor.
And his last name is Frankenstein.
Yeah, you don't. A little hint into the beginning. You don't hear the name Victor for a long time.
And you certainly don't hear the name Frankenstein.
You don't hear the name Frankenstein in this book called Frankenstein until near the end of the first book.
Yep.
You don't know who this guy is. If you came to this completely ignorant, you wouldn't know why this book is called Frankenstein until after a lot of the Frankenstein stuff has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of like Claudius in Hamlet. Hamlet's uncle is named Claudius, and everyone knows that the evil uncle is named Claudius, except for the fact that no one says Claudius in the entire play. It's never spoken. He's only referred to as the king, period. You only know he's called Claudius if you read the play, and that's what he's called like in the stage directions. But it's like you don't know this guy's name, Victor Frankenstein. He's just this guy who shows up
deathly ill because he's in the middle of the Arctic with a bunch of dead dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, stays on the boat because he's going
to... He's not just with a bunch of dead dogs. Like, they were pulling his sled.
Yeah. and he's, like, on the boat, like, passed out. And, like, Robert's like, here, you can have my cabin.
Yeah. So they start forming a friendship.
Robert's, like, the only one who can, like, go in to, like, see him. Because otherwise he gets, like, anxiety attacks, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been through some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this point in the one of his early letters to his sister where he's like,
I really want a friend.
Yeah. He's like, I realize the one thing I've been missing my entire life is a friend. And then he finds a friend.
Mm-hmm.
This hungry man who shows up. And you go through a lot of the, like, they discuss like how they nurse him back to health, like not only physically but mentally, like how he starts trying to get him in a good mental place so he can talk. And over time, Victor, or this guy, starts opening up to him.
Yeah, and it's just, especially after Robert opens up to him.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just a cute little bromance.
Yeah, yes. There is a wonderful bromance between Robert and Victor that starts a bloomin'.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I, like, actually cried when I read, like, I finally found a friend.
Yeah, and I think that it's... This is a part, I believe that this part is dramatized in Ken Branagh's Frankenstein. But even that brushes over the fact that Mary Shelley is clearly setting up parallels between Robert Walton and Victor Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. There's a reason she went in depth into the history of Robert Walton's childhood. And it's mm-hmm. because they are peas in a pod. They are... pretty much this. They're both pursuing knowledge. They are both sort of like not heeding the warnings of their betters, and just plunging into adventure. And Victor,
I really hope Robert doesn't die.
And it's hard. This is an epistolatory part of the book. So you're like, well, he wrote this letter, but we don't know how long he's going to survive. But eventually he gets Victor to open up.
And he starts telling this story. He's like, okay, you're not going to believe me, but everything about this is true.
Oh, right. Because Robert says, hey, we saw another guy on the ice at one point, and Victor's like,
he's like, well, let me tell you a story.
Right, because we learn that Victor has been pursuing someone across the ice. He's not being pursued.
No.
He's pursuing. And this is where we start learning the story
of a man called Frankenstein.
Yes. And what's his story?
Well, when he was young, he had a mom, a dad, and he also had a cousin who lived with him because her parents were like, goodbye.
Yeah, and not only did he have a mom and a dad, he had a mom and a dad who are vastly different in age, like wildly different in age. And you learn like a lot about how like his dad had a friend who had a daughter, and then the friend died. Like, you learn about how his parents met, and his dad is much older than his mother.
Mm-hmm. But they're like really good, like happy, like,
yeah.
They're like, oh, we love our children and we want to raise them. We don't just want to leave them to the nannies.
Yes. They are rich, but they are
humble
and attentive. Mm-hmm. So tell me about Elizabeth.
Elizabeth is the cousin.
Yes.
Yes.
And so in the 1818 book that you read, where does she come from?
She is from like she's from Frankenstein's mom's sister.
Yeah. And the sister dies.
The sister, like, is like, yeah, the sister I'm getting confused with her family and Justine's family.
There's a lot of people whose parents died and get adopted or married in this book in a very short amount of time. But yeah, no, I always confuse her with Justine. Now, what's funny is this is one of those things that she went, so they're cousins, and they've been betrothed to one another.
Yeah, because that was common in the time era.
And from birth, like,
yeah.
Like, just like, I love this little girl so much, you're going to marry her one day. Good. Luckily, they like each other. Now, in 1831, Mary Shelley went back, and she completely rewrote this part of the book. In 1831, she changed it so that Elizabeth is no longer Victor's cousin at all. It's like his parents were overseas, and they found this like family who were extremely poor and had a bunch of kids, but they had this incredibly beautiful young daughter who actually wasn't their daughter. She was an orphan who'd been taken in by this poor family, and then they can't afford to feed her. So Victor's mother is like, well, give her to us. And they're like, all right. And so they give Victor's parents this little girl named Elizabeth, and they take her back. And then Victor's like, but we just pretended she was my cousin. And then the rest of it kind of goes on from there.
That's sketchier than...
She completely rewrites Elizabeth's backstory. And no one really knows why.
Oh, probably because at that time, people were probably a little bit less okay with the cousin weddings.
Well, there's a lot of weird interpretations about Frankenstein. And one of the most common ones is this very psychoanalytic thing about Victor's mother and Victor and like Oedipal stuff and Victor blaming Elizabeth for the, spoiler, death of his mother. Like, and so she would go back and change things to like try to either negate people's theories or reinforce people's theories. We don't really know why, but Elizabeth's backstory was completely changed.
I like her backstory in this one better.
I do too. It's a little simpler.
It's simpler, and it's like, yeah, okay, cousin marriages are now considered gross, but they were common in that time period. Whatever.
Right. And his mother is just like, you guys are gonna marry when you grow up.
Yeah. And they're like, fine.
Yeah, because they love each other.
Uh-huh.
Like Elizabeth and Victor are the best of friends.
Mm-hmm. Like they're also a good bromance, in my opinion.
Speaking of another good bromance, we learn about someone else.
We learn about, I can never pronounce his name.
Henry Clerval, I guess, just Clerval.
Henry Clerval.
Let's talk about Henry.
He's the best.
Do you remember, though, in the movie of Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
Frankenstein's name was changed to Henry Frankenstein.
Yeah, that's the character, though.
And he had a best friend named Victor.
Mm-hmm.
And they swapped names, completely didn't fill us in on who this guy was. But they are...
best friends.
Best friends.
He... Henry, Victor, and Elizabeth are like the true bromance.
Yes, they are our
Ron, Harry, and Hermione.
I wasn't gonna say it, but they are basically literature's first Ron,
golden trio.
Golden trio, like as far as like studious, curious,
BA.
Yeah, like there might be a little bit of a love triangle, but who cares? Like they just respect each other, and they
if
all.
If there's a love triangle, it's Elizabeth loves Victor and Henry loves Victor. That's what I'm saying.
And everyone loves Henry, and
I would marry Henry.
Yeah, and Henry comes from a slightly different family. His father's more strict,
mm-hmm.
doesn't think his son needs to cotton to all that book learning.
Doesn't think education is good.
Yeah.
He thinks that learning things is bad.
Yeah, because he's like, you're going to be a tradesman. You don't need to. And that's another one of the things that gets rewritten a lot is Henry's motivations and background mm-hmm. in the later editions of the book. But in his father's motivations and all the father's motivations get rewritten eventually, like little tweaks that she's like in this version, in the original version, like his father's like, you need to go off to school. And in the rewrite, he's like, I want to go off to school. And people have just been like analyzing why she changed that for years to come. Like it's little tweaks that you're like, I think it's just because she got older and had a different opinion of school age people. Like, I don't know. But, this is around the time, though, that Victor starts talking about his own self-education.
Mm-hmm.
And what does he do?
He reads alchemy books.
Yeah. And what's weird about that?
Well, alchemy has long been disproven.
Yep. And he doesn't know that, though.
No.
So you get a feeling that his formal education is a little wanting.
Yeah. It's a little sketch.
Yeah. Just a little bit.
Just a little.
He reads Agrippa. He reads Paracelsus. He reads Albertus Magnus. He starts reading about the Philosopher's Stone mm-hmm. and the Elixir of Life. And he's like, ooh, this all sounds pretty good.
He's like, who cares about money? I just want that life elixir.
Yeah. He's like, this sounds great because this is our first like hint that there's going to be pursuit in this direction. There's a little passage in here that he basically implies that because he didn't know that the pursuits of the alchemists were folly, that allowed him to pursue them as a science. Like there's this not this like if no one tells you something's impossible, then you're free to just figure it out. It's in the movie Good Will Hunting, there's like an impossible a mathematical formula on the board that no one's ever solved. And because Will Hunting, the janitor, doesn't realize it's impossible to solve, he just looks at it and sits there and he figures it out and he solves it because he doesn't know it's supposed to be hard. And so that's kind of what starts happening with Victor. He's like, oh, no one told me that like these books were outdated and ridiculous. Instead, his father catches him reading Agrippa. And what does his father say to him?
I can't even remember.
He says, my dear Victor, do not waste your time upon this. It is sad trash. It is sad trash.
Can we call that the episode Sad Trash?
Sad Trash. This is going to be Frankenstein episode one, Sad Trash. Calling something sad trash is my new saying. Anything I don't like, I'm just going to call that's sad trash. Because that's a great thing to call something.
I want a shirt that says you are sad trash.
I just want a shirt that just says sad trash. And then like in quotes and then attributed to Frankenstein.
Mary Shelley's 1818 Frankenstein. page blah blah blah.
And he says like if my father had said like no, we've looked at all this stuff. We figured out that this is all completely outdated and impossible.
But it did help us in the future.
Right, but if he's like if my father had bothered to like explain why this was outdated, maybe I would have just been like, "Oh, okay, forget it then." But because his father just kind of dismissed it, he's like, well, I'll just keep reading it then. Which to me is a very true-to-life thing with, like, a kid. Like, if your parent just says...
That's some sad trash right there.
Then you're just going to buckle down and keep reading it, aren't you?
Yep.
which he does. And it's... beneficial, quote unquote, to his future that he does, or I guess in the book, beneficial to the story, because otherwise there would be no story. Also, we get our first hint of some sort of relationship with electricity. His father explains electricity to him, and there's this, like, although electricity isn't spoken of as like the key to his discoveries, it's a big kind of cool thing. Like, there's more to this world. So then he goes off to the university,
and he hates his teacher.
Yeah, but before he goes to university, something happens at his house.
His mom dies.
His mom dies. And how does she die?
She gets, Elizabeth is sick with smallpox?
Scarlet fever.
Scarlet fever. And his mom is like, no, I must go take care of her.
Well, okay, so there's two versions of this. Again, here's where the two books diverge. In our version, the 1818 version, she gets better. And then the mother is like, oh, I can go visit her now. And they're like, no, wait, she's not completely fine. And then the mother goes in and gets scarlet fever and dies.
Yeah.
In the 31 version, she doesn't get better. Elizabeth is still very sick, and the mother insists on ministering to her in her illness. And it's subtle, but that's two different, like, variations.
Yeah. Although I think that in this one, the mom was like, she was, they could barely keep her from going in to help Elizabeth. Like that. And when the, like, nurse or whatever was like, yeah, she's better, but she's still contagious, the mom was like, too late.
Yeah.
She's gone.
Yeah. It's a major turning point in Victor's life. He basically says, like, this is...
Also, what's happened at his house since he started telling the story, he has two brothers now.
Oh, right. There's these two guys who you don't learn much about.
There's Ernest and William.
And William.
Who is William based on? Let me tell you.
Oh, was there a William in Mary Shelley's life?
Yes.
Oh, who is
this? Her dead son.
Yeah.
It talks about it when William's first introduced. They're like, so Mary Shelley started writing this book in July of blah, 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 and her son died in June. And I was like.
And she's like, I'm going to write this character and call him William. And if you know anything about, well, we'll get to it, but. This isn't a subtle, like, if you know her biography, these are not subtle clues. Mary Shelley's mother died when she was like born. She never knew her mother.
I know, because her father, like, hated her for it.
Well, he had a weird relationship with her for it. Her father was very kind to her, but it colored her upbringing. So the whole theme of dead mothers, and she hated her stepmother. So the whole theme of dead mothers is a touchy subject for
Wasn't
her.
Wasn't she, like, sent off because her stepmother was like, I don't want to deal with you.
Yeah. They had a fraught relationship. Plus she was surrounded by step siblings, like, after that. But, not that she, like, suffered much. Like, she had a pretty free and easy upbringing, but there's a lot of stuff in here about dead parents and death. And Mary Shelley knew her share of death.
Yeah.
So Victor's still, like, in grief, but he goes off to Ingolstadt.
Yeah, and, like, Elizabeth's like, please don't go.
Right, right. And Henry's like, please don't go.
And everyone else is like, well, except for his dad. His dad's like, you have to go.
You have to go.
And everyone else is like, don't go.
Yeah.
And Henry's and Victor's like, well, guess I gotta go.
But he says that he gets into the thing into the chaise to convey him away, and he says something that I actually highlighted because it stuck with me. Four words. He says, "I was now alone," and this is our first time that Victor has been completely isolated in his entire life. He's not surrounded by friends or family, and loneliness is a theme in this book. It's a big part of this book, like being abandoned and being alone. And I think that the words, I was now alone, is kind of this turning point. No one's watching him. No one's checking up on him.
Which is not good, as we know.
Not good. And so he starts meeting his professors.
And there's one that he's like, oop, don't like you.
Yep. M. Krimp, Monsieur Krimp, who basically says, what have you been reading? Sad trash. He says, good God, in what desert land have you lived where no one was kind enough to inform you that these fancies which you have so greedily imbibed are 1,000 years old and as musty as they are ancient? I little expected in this enlightened and scientific age to find a disciple of Albertus Magnus and Paracelsus. My dear sir, you must begin your studies entirely anew. Yeah, that's the guy he doesn't really like that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And well, he like respects him later on.
Though. Right. They're not. He's not a. He's not like Snape.
No.
But he makes a bad impression. He's ugly. Like Victor doesn't like the fact this guy's ugly.
Same.
he was a squat little man with a repulsive countenance. But
that's
then
a good sentence.
Yes. There's a lot of good sentences in here. And then he meets Monsieur Waldman, who's a lot nicer, mm-hmm. his other teacher.
He's like, oh, yes, these might be old, but they did help us progress scientifically.
Yes. So two different views on ancient scientific thought. He's like, yeah, like we know all this stuff isn't true, but it got your mind working. It made you a thinker. And so they start hanging out a little bit more.
Is he the one with the tiny men?
Oh, is he the one who ended up building tiny men for the... We haven't gotten to that. We haven't... There's an episode of the show coming up that we already recorded a long time ago in which there are tiny men.
Mm-hmm.
Small men. Kings and queens.
And other things.
Yep, we'll get to that. Bride of Frankenstein. So he starts studying the sciences, like, for serious.
Mm-hmm.
And studying them a little too much. He doesn't have any friends. He has
no
social life. And he starts studying anatomy and chemistry and death. Yeah, this is where he starts sort of Frankensteining out.
I like the... Can I just read the part that the other guy says about the books?
Yeah.
The ancient teachers of this science, he said, promised impossibilities and performed nothing. The modern masters promise very little. They know that metals cannot be transmuted and that the elixir of life is a chimera. But these philosophers, whose hands seem only made to dabble in dirt and their eyes to pore over the microscope or crucible, have indeed performed miracles. They penetrate into the recesses of nature and show how she works in her hiding places. They ascend into the heavens. They have discovered how the blood circulates and the nature of the air we breathe. They have acquired new and almost unlimited powers. They can command the thunders of heaven, mimic the earthquake, and mock the invisible world with its own shadows.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's a great passage. Can I read you a passage?
Mm-hmm.
Or everyone a passage? It's being recorded on audio. He starts... the pursuit of the creation of life in this book kind of just happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no major, and then I decided to build a man. It was just kind of like I started exploring. One thing I love about this book is the way Mary Shelley illustrates his development from A to B to, like, it makes sense how he came to this.
Because, like, A, he wasn't being monitored by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
He was just being, like his teacher was like, oh, yes, keep doing what you're doing. You're getting very smart.
Yeah, this isn't a mad scientist.
No, he's like, oh, they want me to keep doing this? Okay.
Yeah, he's just, like, a curious kid, basically. He's young. Like,
yeah.
This is a young guy.
He's
and
like, I want to discover new things.
Yeah.
Didn't he, like, discover a bunch of new things that, in, like, science for the college or something?
Right. Some of the stuff worked, and they were like, great, thank you so much for doing this. Like, it's this unfettered exploration of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And because he doesn't know things are impossible, he just keeps going. And he says, to examine the causes of life, we must first have recourse to death. I became acquainted with the science of anatomy, but this was not sufficient. I must also observe the natural decay and corruption of the human body. In my education, my father had taken the greatest precautions that my mind should be impressed with no supernatural horrors. I do not ever remember to have trembled at tale of superstition or to have feared the apparition of a spirit. Darkness had no effect upon my fancy, and a churchyard was to me merely the receptacle of bodies deprived of life, which, from being the seat of beauty and strength, now became food for the worm. Now I was led to examine the cause and progress of this decay and forced to spend days and nights in vaults and charnel houses. My attention was fixed upon every object, the most insupportable to the delicacy of the human feelings. I saw how the fine form of man was degraded and wasted, and I beheld the corruption of death succeeded to the blooming cheek of life. I saw how the worm inherited the wonders of the eye and brain. And you just sort of are taken on this, like... He says, I'm not recording the vision of a madman. The sun does not more certainly shine in the heavens than that which I now affirm is true. Some miracle might have produced it, yet the stages of the discovery were distinct and probable. After days and nights of incredible labor and fatigue, I succeeded in discovering the cause of generation and life. Nay, more, I became myself capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter.
And then he's like, but I can't tell you how.
Right.
Because that would be too much power for mm-hmm. you.
He just drops that in there. He's like, so by degrees, I just figured out how all this works.
And then he like brought a rabbit back to life or something.
What?
Didn't he like restore life to like an animal before he moved on to humans?
No, he says that he could have, but that it made more sense just to move on to people.
That makes no sense.
He was like, I could have done this with an animal. I could have started small, but I think I should just have started big because that's the kind of dude I am. And he says, when I found so astonishing a power placed within my hands, I hesitated a long time concerning the manner in which I should employ it. Although I possess the capacity of bestowing animation, yet to prepare a frame for the reception of it, mm-hmm. with all its intricacies of fibers, muscles, and veins, remained a work of inconceivable difficulty and labor.
Is that why is that the Bride of Frankenstein, that guy like has like that secret tomb?
Yeah, it's kind of that, where like he's sort of digging through the dead and like looking at how stuff works and is put together. I love that he says, though, that he starts creating, because it's so difficult to work with the little inside pieces of bodies, he has to create a giant man because it's easier to work with. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, that's why the monster is so big. It's easier to work with. Like, mm-hmm. he made bigger veins and, I guess, bigger nerves. Like, all the little bits and pieces. He says he begins with the creation of the human being. Yeah, that's it. And he's doing all this basically to stop death. Like,
because he's become obsessed with death after his mother's death or something.
Right. And I love that this isn't a crazy guy who's like trying to play God. It's a scientist, an unfettered young scientist.
Who was not told that the impossible was actually impossible.
Yeah. And so he just does the impossible.
He's like, oh, I figured out the secret to life.
Yep.
And now I'm going to do what I can with it.
And he is becoming pretty pale and sick at this point.
Because nobody's monitoring him, so he's just spending days upon days in the basement of a graveyard.
Yep. In his solitary chamber, in his cell at the top of a house. So he's doing all this in an apartment complex, basically. He lives down below, and he has the attic, and he's putting a guy together. And so, like, and he's doing this for a while, and people keep writing him and are like, you doing all right?
He's like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, okay.
And then it's done.
Yeah, I mean, he goes along. He talks philosophically about his creation for a while, about how he's ignoring people. And then he says, it was on a dreary night of November I beheld the accomplishment of my toils with an anxiety that almost amounted to agony. I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 a.m. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burned out. But when by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a compulsive motion agitated its limbs. And then what happens?
He runs.
He freaks out.
I'd freak out. Like, people are like, oh, Victor Frankenstein was such a terrible person for leaving the monster behind. I'm like, so you're telling me if you didn't have if you saw a decomposing human body come to life that you made, you wouldn't run?
Well, it wasn't decomposing. That's the thing. It's a beautiful man that he created. He says, I mean, he has yellow skin, but he has pearly white teeth, lustrous black and flowing hair. And one of the things that people bring up is they're like, wait a minute, you've been looking at this thing for months, and now you're afraid of it?
It wasn't alive before.
That's what I always come back to. It didn't – what I love about this moment, people are like, oh, he just doesn't like it because it's ugly. And I'm like, he doesn't like it because he did something horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And he didn't realize what he was doing until the minute it opened its eyes.
And he saw hell in its eyes.
Yeah, the unnaturalness of what he's done suddenly just, like, hits him. And he's like, oh, no. Like, all that isolation and that those sleepless nights and the fatigue and the lack of nourishment just goes away. And he suddenly sees clearly.
And he's like, oh, got a blast.
I created a nightmare. And what does he do? And I love... I love what he does.
He like runs into his bedroom or something.
And he hides behind the curtains and he throws the covers over his head and he's like, no, 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 no. And then what does the creation do?
It comes in.
It like opens the curtains and peeks in at him.
And he's like, gotta go.
He runs out of the house. Somehow the monster or the creature or the thing found its way from the attic to his bedroom without anyone in the house waking up. And then found its way out without anyone in the house.
And somehow traveled all the way to his hometown.
Well, we'll get there. So, a little aside. This is the point where a lot of people, there is a theory, a literary theory, more or less, that's not always substantiated by the book, but there's clues throughout, that this didn't actually happen. There is a theory that he didn't create life. Nothing was on that table. He just sort of went nuts in this attic and convinced himself that he had done something horrible. That's all played into his guilt over his mother, his guilt over Elizabeth, other things that happen that get compounded by the plot that's coming up.
And for all we know, he could have been the man on the sled in the Arctic.
Right. We don't really know. Like, we know because Mary Shelley has said so, but there's a theory which states that there never was a monster.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs out of the house.
He's like, gotta go.
And he sort of lives on the streets for a little while. Like,
for a few hours.
For a few hours, yeah. Like, he's just sort of like roaming around in his delirium. He's sick. We got to remember that he's very sick.
Yeah.
And he hasn't been taking care of himself. And then, by coincidence, runs into
Henry.
Yeah. Who's showing up just to like visit.
He's like,
or no, he's showing up to go to school.
Yeah. Because he was finally like, I'm going to school, Dad. You can't control me anymore.
And Victor just runs into him and Henry's like, well, first of all, this is the first time in the entire book we hear the name.
Victor.
No.
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. If you're reading this book for the first time and you had no idea who Victor Frankenstein was, you'd be like, I don't know why this book is called Frankenstein. I don't even know what that is.
We went over that.
Yep. This is the moment, though. Henry says, Frankenstein, my dear Frankenstein. And you're like, oh, it's his last name. Near the end of this section. He nurses him back to health. It takes a long time, like months.
And he's like he misses school for it.
Yeah, like he takes care of his friend.
He's like, oh, you're really sick and you need my help. I will throw everything to the side.
And meanwhile, Victor is like babbling about this, like, I made a man. I made a monster man. Please. And Henry's like, I went up to your lab. There was nothing there. I assume there were no meat parts hanging around in this lab either. So either Henry cleaned stuff up and just kept shut up about it, or Victor didn't have anything in that lab. One of the two.
Or he just was really neat with his lab.
Yeah.
Because there was, like, equipment in there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the monster was also stumbling around. Something was going... In any case, we don't really know. Because Victor was, like, delirious this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So, he nurses him back to health, and then he gets a letter from home.
Well, first, they're happy.
Yes, they're happy for a while.
Can I talk about how they're happy and yes. How I love that they're happy?
Please talk about how happy they are.
Frankenstein... Since he's been, like, creating this monster, hasn't been able to enjoy the beauties of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on this long tangent about how, like, beautiful, like, the flowers looked in the springtime and stuff. And he, like, writes to his family about how much he loves them and all that stuff. And it makes me so happy.
Right. And I guess we have to have this because stuff comes crashing down pretty quickly
mm-hmm.
when he gets a letter from home. And they even give us a nice little, like, oh, letter from home.
Oh, by the way, your brother's been murdered.
Yeah. So let's talk about William again.
Let's.
Little boy William. William's considerably younger than Victor.
And he's also described as like the most beautiful child you've ever seen.
Yep. He's lovely. He's very small and young and innocent. And he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
He went for a walk in the woods with his brother.
And yeah, his brother.
And his brother comes back and he's like, I can't find William.
Well, first
anywhere.
He's like, hey, do you guys, is William with you guys? And they're like, no, we thought he was with you. He's
yeah.
Like, no.
So they all set out to look for this little boy lost in the woods, and eventually they find him.
And he's dead.
Not just dead, but murdered. A Murder Most Foul.
Yeah.
Oh, and he had a locket that had one of the things they found fingerprints on his neck, and his locket was missing that had a picture of his dead mother.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us.
It was a very expensive locket.
Let's go back in time. Tell us about Justine.
Justine. Well, we haven't learned much about her yet.
Yeah, so she becomes a central player all of a sudden. We're led to believe she's always... It's a weird moment in the story because it's kind of like when you're watching a TV show and like two seasons in, they introduce a character who's supposed to have been like very important to everyone for the whole time. And you're like, I've never heard of this person. All of a sudden, they start talking about Justine and Elizabeth's like, you remember Justine? And you're like, wait a minute, who? Why did... This is a book. You could have just thrown her in anytime.
Could have gone back and edited.
First of all, Victor finds out that his little brother has been murdered and is sad. Very sad. Mm-hmm. At what point do we find out, though, that they've quote-unquote caught the killer?
That's after he goes back.
Okay. So he rushes home.
Well, first, there's a long tangent about Justine.
Okay. So who is Justine?
Justine is like a member of the household who is like family.
Yeah.
Who was taken in because her family was like, we don't want you.
Yeah.
Go away.
Right. So she's a sad character. We do learn a lot about Justine, though.
And how she's like pretty and she's really nice. And
she's basically a member of the family. They took her in as a servant, but because of who they are, they don't treat her like a servant. They treat her like a sister. Mm-hmm. And they let her get educated. And then she goes back home at some point to take care of her mother, who was a jerk to her. And
because her mother thought that. No, she didn't go to take care of her mother. Her mother thought that God was punishing her for being mean to her child.
Right. And then...
she's like, you got to come back so God can forgive me.
Yeah. And then she treats her like garbage again. And then Justine goes back to live with the Frankensteins. Mm-hmm. And it's this... you learn a lot about Justine in a very short amount of time.
I like Justine.
But it's one of those things where I'm like, you could have introduced her earlier in the book, rather than like crammed her all into like these last couple of chapters. Mm-hmm. Because, Victor goes home. He's walking through the woods. So at this point, cities close down. Mm-hmm. They shut their gates. This is still a thing that's happening. And he can't get into the city.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kind of has to wander around in the woods because he's distressed. And he goes by the spot where his brother was killed. And there's lightning, and he sees something.
What does he see?
A monster.
A monsterman.
He sees his creation. He sees the thing he created kind of just staring at him.
And he knows.
And then it climbs a cliff really fast.
Like a cliff that should be impossible to climb.
Yeah, he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. This thing is huge, and it's strong, and it's here, and it's looking at me, and I think this thing killed my brother.
He doesn't think it. He knows it.
He knows for a fact this thing killed his brother. This is the murderer. This is the monster that murders.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day he gets home and his other brother is there and they cry. And Elizabeth is there and they cry. And they're like, good news though, dude. We caught the killer.
He's like, how did you catch him?
He's like, you could not have caught the killer. The killer is a monster and so powerful. And they're like,
what the hell are you talking about?
And they're like, well, it wasn't too hard because it was Justine.
And he's like, no.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't.
He's like,
stop.
He's like, it couldn't have been, but I can't tell you who it was because you'd think I was nuts.
Now, I might be nuts. Who knows?
Who knows? Also, we're in a weird part of the book because Victor is pretty sure that Justine is innocent, but he can't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or he doesn't say anything.
Like, I don't think he's legally allowed to at this point because he wasn't there.
Right. We don't know much about... I don't know much about the justice system in Geneva. Like, in 18...
18.
Or late 1700s, because that's when this all happened. I don't really know what he is and isn't allowed to do. All I know is that Justine has been arrested for the murder of this little boy because she was acting weird the night he disappeared. And then they found the locket.
In her pocket.
But she doesn't know how the locket got there.
Yeah, she's like, I have no idea what's going on.
And she's being really weird and evasive also. Like, she's kind of, like, taken off guard by all this.
Well, I would be taken off guard if I, like, came home, like, la-da-da family, and, like, someone was like, you killed our son.
But then she confesses to the crime. And that's...
This is where the Hunchback of Notre Dame comes back.
Oh, yeah?
Because she's like, I didn't want to confess. I did it under severe pressure.
By
the guy who wanted me to confess.
Who is?
The confessator?
Basically the church.
Yeah.
Is like, you need to confess to this or you're going to go to hell.
And she's like, but I didn't do anything.
And they're like, yeah, but hell. And she's like, all right, I did it. And they're like, we told you she did it. Here's another point in the book where this whole section is substantially rewritten. Like, whole chunks were cut and rewritten. So, Justine goes to trial. And Elizabeth is basically there as a character witness. There's all these other character witnesses who won't talk at the trial because everyone hates Justine. They all think that she did it.
Yeah, but Elizabeth's like, she didn't do it.
She didn't do it. And she's like, I confess, but I didn't really do it. And here's all these people who will tell you that I'm actually a good person. And they're like, forget it. We don't want everyone to basically hate us for protecting you. And so they go. So she's basically found guilty. Elizabeth and Victor go to talk to her. And they're like, I wish I could do something for you, but... And she's like, it's cool, as long as you guys know I'm innocent, I'm fine with being executed tomorrow. And they're like, all right, I wish we could do something for you. And Victor's like, this is where I'm like, dude, he's like, she was pretty upset that she was going to be executed, but I pretty much felt worse than she did. And he keeps saying this. He's like, I was really the one feeling the worst in that room. I'm like, no, dude, you probably weren't. I think the woman who's going to be executed for a crime she didn't commit is the one feeling the worst.
Yeah.
Which leads us to another thing, which is if the monster didn't really exist, there's a chance she did it. They actually set it up so that you can believe that she did it, that she was consumed by jealousy for the love that was being shown to this child that she always wished was hers because she had a mother who didn't love her, but she always loved Elizabeth, and she always hated William because he was the child that she wished she was. There's all these like psychological like things mm-hmm. going on, and that in a fit of like jealousy, she killed this kid mm-hmm. and stole this necklace and then like regretted it or didn't remember it. And so there's a theory going around that's been going around for over 100 years.
There's a theory that's been going around recently.
For over 200 years, or a little more, almost 200 years, that Justine did kill William.
Next year it will be 200 years old.
Yep. And that Victor shows up and muddies the waters, and that she's like, I didn't do it. And he's like, oh. But because of this, her execution becomes another death that he puts on himself. First mm-hmm. William, and now Justine. And
like, what is the townspeople going to do when they find out the monster did it?
I don't know.
I hope they feel guilty.
But we find that there's this guy who hates himself already for creating something so horrible. Then he hates himself for creating something that killed a little boy.
His brother, no less.
And now he hates himself because an innocent person is being killed because of this thing he created.
And he stated in the beginning or whatever that he was too young to learn to hate himself just yet.
Yeah.
And then, but he did. No, wait, no, that was different. That was a different book that I've been reading.
Wait, which book was that?
The first book in the Dark Tower series.
Very different book.
It's my new independent reading book.
But yeah, things have gone from bad to
sort
worse.
Bad.
To worse. To worse.
And Elizabeth's like,
yeah. And with that, that's the end of
section one,
book one of the 1818 edition of Frankenstein. So it ends on a down note. We've been through a lot already, and everything is terrible. He gets home, yeah, and he sees his creation. He knows this thing's now like somehow aware of his life. Who he is following him around, or is preceding him and getting to things and tormenting his family. And oh God, what next?
Like just reading this section makes me wonder how anyone could feel sympathy for the monster.
That's the brilliance of the three book division, is that it's divided into three not distinct narratives, but it's very purposefully structured this way. And when she went back and edited it into one long book, it kind of muddied the water a little bit as far as the way the narrative's divided up. But he says, the last paragraph of this book is amiable cousin. So Elizabeth talks to him about how, like, the innocent are suffering, but at least we think she's innocent. And he says, amiable cousin, such were your thoughts, mild and gentle as your own dear eyes and voice. But I was a wretch, and none ever conceived of the misery that I then endured. And that's the end of book one. And then book two picks up with some more fun adventures of Victor Frankenstein. But that's the end of book one. So we're almost at the end of our episode here, but what are your thoughts so far?
I really like it.
Do you... I was like, oh no, have I assigned a book that you're going to find incredibly dull?
The only part I didn't like was when you were like, read the book.
Well, I was worried. I was like, oh no, what if you don't finish this part of the book? Because it's, when you start off, it's very jarring in the beginning when you're like, who's this guy? Who's this sailor man? Like, I thought this is a book about it.
I had to read the first few pages out loud before I could really get into like the language of it.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it was fine.
Yeah, because you've got two clashing authors, Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley, whose styles are a little different.
Shelley's like straightforward, like basic description.
Yep.
Really good characters. And Percy's like, whilst the flower petals fell onto the ground. And I'm like.
But not to knock Percy. He did a lot of editing and stuff that actually helped, I think, this narrative move along. He had to throw in his two cents every once in a while.
Which is fine. I mean, it's a little like kicker every once in a while.
Yeah. But she's built a great story.
And great characters.
Mm-hmm. Victor Frankenstein's not one of literature's great heroes by any mean, but he's a fascinating guy.
And he feels guilty about what he's done. He's right. Like, oh, I made a huge mistake. I have to fix this somehow.
Right. And
he's just a guy.
And I want to say right off the bat, at the end of the first bat.
At the end of the first pitch.
That this book is frequently framed as a warning against delving into knowledge that you were never meant to know. But that's not supported by what this book seems to be about.
It's about accepting your consequences.
It's about owning up to what you've done.
Yeah, it's about trying to fix the mistakes that you've made and not blaming someone else.
But it's also about guilt and loneliness and the dangers of being alone and not having a circle of close acquaintances around you.
Not having someone to check in on you every once in a while.
Because Victor wasn't delving into things he shouldn't have known. He was just following along his studies.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is cool. This is cool. I can do this. But there was never any moment of like, it's alive. I am God. It was more just like,
oh God, it's alive. Why?
Yeah. Oh no. What did I do? Like,
and I made a grave error.
And he and running away and hiding under the covers because
he's just a child.
He's a kid. He's a young guy.
He's like a couple years older than me.
He's got like no experience in the real world.
Yeah.
Like, and
he was he had a sheltered upbringing.
And it's that thing where you make a few choices in your life and you suddenly see them barreling out of control and you're like, no. And you're trying to hold them back. But and even like with Justine, you're like, or I'm like, he's doing what people do. Where he's like, I've got to make this right, but I'm really embarrassed at what I did.
He's a teenager.
I guess he's in his 20s at this point, but
but a couple years older than
me. But he's acting like a scared teenager.
Because that's pretty much what he is, maturity wise.
Yeah, and he doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. And I'm excited about going on to the next book.
I relate to him.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun stuff happening in the second book in this series. I am so happy to be exploring it with you. I hope everyone else is happy to be exploring it with us. Mm-hmm. So your homework for next week
is to read section two.
Read book two. And
I have enough homework. Don't call it homework. Call it like
fun work.
No, that's what my English teacher calls it.
Oh. Happy times.
No.
Or your
responsibilities.
Yes. Your responsibility for the next chunk is
I did get that second load in, by the way. Of laundry.
Thank you. Speaking of responsibilities, already, huh? What's it been doing?
It is currently sitting waiting for me to change it into the dryer.
Yay! So, like Victor Frankenstein, You've got a job.
My mistakes are spiraling out of control.
Your laundry creation is awaiting its master. So we haven't even met this monster yet. We don't know anything about this creation.
No. All I know is he's murdered a child in cold blood.
And someone has taken the fall. So next week, book 2, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Please join us. I am looking forward to this.
So am I.
And as far as your teacher, Mr.
Doty,
I had a teacher named Mrs. Doty when I was in school.
I don't think they're related. Maybe they're related. I don't know. Hey, Mr. Doty, where did you come from? Where did you go?
Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Doe?
D.
Please don't.
Please don't fail please me. Don't fail.
Until next time, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.